This is joint work with Benjamin Mood, Abhi Shalat, and Kevin Butler. And our system is called PCF, and it's a system for scaling secure two-party computation. So in secure two-party computation, the two parties are going to try to compute a function that requires input from each of them in such a way that each party's input is not leaked to the other party, and that they have a guarantee that their outputs are correct. And a key result here is that we can create a secure two-party protocol for any computable function. Now, in order for this to work, the manner in which we evaluate the function f in the protocol has to be oblivious. So, for example, the code snippet on the bottom is not oblivious because the control flow leaks information about f. In other words, the manner in which we assign a value to y depends on the value of an input. So, in an oblivious program, the control flow, memory accesses, and other side channels have to be independent of the inputs. And a key result in this is that for any Turing machine, we can create an oblivious Turing machine with only a logarithmic overhead. Now, this is a theoretical result because that logarithmic overhead is always present even when it's unnecessary. This result gives a similar construction for circuit families from Turing machines, which again is not used in practice because of this extra cost. So to convert the example from before into an oblivious program, what we need to do is evaluate each branch and then combine them using a multiplexer. And this is what we need to do in our tools for secure computation to actually create the representations that we use in the protocols. Now, over the past 10 years, there's been substantial progress in creating practical and scalable protocols for secure computation. And circa 2011 and 2012, we basically solved the problem of scaling the secure protocol itself. Unfortunately, we now have tools for those protocols that don't scale very well. So for example, the early Fairplay compiler had difficulty generating circuits with more than 100,000 gates. And the more recent KSS-12 compiler was able to get up to a billion gates, but had a lot of difficulty and required very expensive hardware to get that far. So in this work, we're going to address the scalability problem in the tool chain. Now, the previous approach to the tool chain looked something like this. You start with a high-level language, often a domain-specific language, and then compile it directly into a circuit. And so you're going to unroll all your loops, inline all your functions, and flatten out the conditionals as I described before. And at the end of this process, you wind up with a list of gates that look something like this. We give each wire in the circuit a unique ID, and then specify how that wire gets its value from other wires. And the problem here is that the size of this list, the storage size, is going to scale with the worst case running time of the function. And all of the tools used to generate it also have to spend as much time as the worst case running time of the function. And to give an example of how bad this can get, here are a few functions that are not very hard to evaluate in the plane model without secure computation. And as you can see, while we're able to do many of them, there's very, very long compile times that are needed, and our storage sizes are big. And we're also not able to get to some of them. For example, we couldn't do 1,024-bit RSA. And in another previous work, we had trouble even getting large integer multiplications. Related to this problem is the problem of actually evaluating the circuits once we have them. So a typical approach to this is to create a table for the values of the wires, and then to walk through the circuit, putting wire values into that table. Unfortunately, this means that the memory requirement of the runtime system is also going to scale with the worst case running time of the function. In KSS-12, we made the observation that we can actually freeze some of the wires, and we did this by reference counting. So, when a wire is used as an input, we decrement its reference count, and when the reference counts equals zero, we can free the memory used for the wires. The first key insight in this work is that the reference counts themselves aren't actually needed. In fact, we don't need to give the wires unique IDs. Instead, we'll create a wire table and identify the wires by their indices in that table. The compiler has enough high-level information to know when a wire is no longer needed, and thus its index can be overridden. This is a simpler approach than reference counting, and it has a constant factor savings. We spend less time in the compiler trying to compute the reference count, and we need less space to store this. But the really good thing about this is that it opens the door to our second insight. In our second insight, we realize that we don't actually need to store the circuit at all. Instead, we can store a control flow graph where the basic blocks can be thought of as pieces of the circuit. Control flow graphs are already used in the compiler for optimization and for certain other forms of program analysis, so this is straightforward. And the key to this is that on certain state transitions, we're actually going to emit the gates that we need for the circuit. So this can be thought of as a just-in-time gate generation technique. And combined with our previous insight, it means we're not actually dealing with circuits. We're dealing with programs. And so the PCF system is the combination of these two ideas. The nice thing about it is that we don't actually have to change the underlying secure computation protocol. All we did was output a list of gates, and so you can use it as if you had been reading it from a file. This also means that we don't need to make any compromises on security. We've been running our experiments in the malicious model. So at runtime, here's what our system looks like. We can go through a bit of initialization and then start entering control structures such as a loop. At certain points, we start outputting gates. At other points, we can move things around our wire table, and we can follow control structures, emitting more gates and moving things again, and so forth. Now, the third insight in our system is that we don't need to start with a high-level language. We can decouple the front end that actually parses the high-level language from our back end and only use the bytecode intermediate representation. This means that we can actually support any language for secure computation. In our prototype, we use the LCC compiler and supported C. We dump the output of the IR straight into our PCF compiler. We don't make any changes to C. We only make certain restrictions on what sort of programs you can execute. So for example, your loop termination conditions can't depend on input values. There's nothing particularly special about LCC here. We could use other front ends. The nice thing about this is that with our experimental system, we've been able to scale up to at least tens of billions of gates using hardware of a typical laptop computer. And it was not difficult to scale up to this, so we could have kept going. Here are some examples of what our C source code looks like. You can see that we don't need any special annotations here. We're really just using standard C grammar and standard C control structures. Here's a more interesting example, a regular expression matching function. And again, nothing special, no extra control or statements or declarations anywhere in here. So for the rest of this talk, we'll talk about some of the technical issues that we encountered actually implementing this. Now, in older systems that could read domain-specific languages or start directly from an HLL, from a high-level language, we get certain guarantees about our branches. They have a nice structure to them that we can take advantage of. So in Fairplay and KSS12, for example, we use this algorithm based on a stack. After creating our condition wires, when we reach a branch, we push its target onto the stack along with the condition wire. We can then go through, come to more branches, push them on, and when we get to a branch target, we pop the condition wire off the stack and emit multiplexers for the assignment made in the branch. Likewise, we get to the next target, we go through all assignments made in the branch, including the sub-branches, and emit muxes for those. Unfortunately, bytecode is a little bit less structured, and we can wind up with a situation like this, where one branch target is actually inside of another branch, so they overlap. Our strategy for dealing with this involves switching the stack for a priority queue and maintaining a global condition wire that we'll use for our multiplexers, which we emit for each assignment. And the global condition wire can be thought of as representing the conditions that would have to have been true for us to get to a particular program point. And so here, we emit our conditions, we get to a branch, augment the condition wire with the fall through case, and push the branch condition and target into the priority queue. When we get to an assignment, we immediately output the multiplexer using the current state of the global condition wire. And when we get to another branch, we insert its target and condition in priority order, and the priority here is the order in which the targets appear. And when we get to a branch target, we again augment the condition wire to indicate that there's another way that we can get to the program points after this label. We also need to handle loops. So when a branch goes in the backwards direction, we're going to follow a common assumption, which is that it's being used to build a loop of some sort. And we're going to enforce one rule here. You can't have this branch condition depend on an input value. We enforce that in our runtime system. We leave it up to the user to prevent infinite loops from being created. Our optimization strategy here is divided into two stages. Statically, we use techniques based on data flow analysis, and our circuit sizes are reduced as a side effect of reducing the number of state transitions in the PCF program. At runtime, we'll apply certain logic simplification rules to our gates to check for things such as constant outputs. If the gate has a constant output, we won't bother to emit it. And we found that this optimization strategy works well. In a simple case, such as our millionaires problem, we're very competitive. In other cases, we start to get into certain differences between how we emit code, how we actually generate our circuits. So for example, in integer multiplication, the KSS-12 compiler is slightly better. For matrix multiplication, we're actually a winner, and there's some oddities about how the KSS-12 compiler is emitting the circuits here. For our big result, this is the storage size reduction. We're looking at orders of magnitude improvement here. We also have orders of magnitude improvement in our compile times, and we're able to go to things that we couldn't do before. We can do, for example, a generic RSA 1024. We're also able to scale up beyond that if needed. And in fact, the bottleneck here was testing the secure protocol itself and actually running this. Now, this approach can be compared with the circuit library approaches that have been presented in previous work. In those approaches, the programmer is given a library for a high-level language and then composes the gadgets in that library by hand in the high-level language. So these protocols, or these systems, scale very well because the circuit's never stored anywhere. Instead, you're writing a program which will generate that circuit at runtime. And this is similar to what PCF does. You can think of PCF as compressing the circuit automatically to generate such a program. A key difference is that in PCF, both the building and the optimization of the circuits are automatic. And in the case of optimization, the circuit library approaches generally limit optimization to the gadgets themselves. But in PCF, we can do optimizations across gadget boundaries. So we believe that our approach subsumes the circuit library approach. You can think of each of the bytecode instructions that we read in the front end as specifying which gadget should be used or how to compose them based on the control structure. And you could theoretically add new gadgets by augmenting the bytecode itself and adding new instructions. To use PCF in a system, we've developed and have, or will soon release, it's available upon request, a library that includes the PCF interpreter. And the interface to the library is very simple. There's only two functions, one to load a PCF file and one to get the gates one at a time. So it's very similar to opening a file and reading it line by line or gate by gate. And again, this is available upon request and will be posted very shortly. And we're happy to work with you to integrate this system into your secure computation system if you're working in this field. So please feel free to contact us. So the conclusion of this is, we have scalable secure protocols, and now we have a scalable toolchain for those protocols. And looking forward towards our future work, we're very interested in adapting this to other settings. So in addition to Boolean circuits, our immediate goal is to move towards arithmetic circuits to support things like multi-party computation with more than two parties, FHE, and verifiable computation, which is a somewhat newer concept. We're also curious about other computation models, like ORAMs, or models based on graphs. And finally, there's certain new optimization techniques that we're seeking to develop to address certain issues. For example, accumulators in loops tend to expand the number of bits they need very quickly in these sorts of systems, and we're looking into ways to scale that better so that we don't need a human to determine that they don't grow that fast. And I've got quite a bit of time for questions, so I open the floor to questions.
anyone have any questions? Want to come up? For shame. All right. I have a few questions. They're kind of detailed questions, but just one detailed question is, you had a list of compile times, I believe, on the previous slide, and I didn't see the units on those. Were those hours or what was it?
Those seconds? Were seconds.
Okay, good. You just have to ask. This is, you know. But actually, the kind of the real question I had is, you made a number of assumptions about being loops would always be backwards branches and so on. Did you run into, across any language maybe that you dealt with, did you run into counterexamples that kind of made this difficult for you?
For that particular assumption that backwards branches are used to build loops, no. We actually haven't been able to come up with a test case where that's false. We do have a backup plan should we encounter it. We can, to some degree, statically analyze the bytecode to determine if we're actually in something that looks more like a loop or something that's just a very, very strange way to create an if statement.
That's my question. So thank you very much. If there are no other questions, let's thank the... Oh, there is a question, so...
Hi, my question is, if you're not evaluating the full depth of the circuit, I assume it's cut off at some point due to a condition. How do you avoid the information leakage associated with cutting off the computation early? You said the loops are not supposed to depend on private inputs, but is that true of all control flow?
So for branches in the forward direction, for things like if statements or switches, those can depend on private inputs, and that's why we need to flatten them and use multiplexers. So that won't leak anything. And we actually don't terminate our loops early at all. That's why it's the user's responsibility to ensure that they don't wind up creating infinite loops. So as long as your termination condition doesn't depend on input, we'll just keep going through the loop and keep iterating until the termination condition is actually met. So this isn't really like the bounded model checking approaches, where loops get converted into long nests of if statements. This is more like executing a program.
Thank you.
Thank the speaker again.